Good afternoon and welcome to Living Permaculture on KDNK. I'm Vanessa Harmony of Colorado Edible Forest, Plant Nursery and Consulting in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. I'm excited about today's show because it brings together two fields with a lot in common, although some people might be surprised to consider them related: regenerative ranching and permaculture design. In today's episode, I'll air part two of my interview with Glenn Elzinga of Alder Spring Ranch in May, Idaho. Glenn describes how his operation uses in-herding, stockmanship, and targeted grazing as tools to restore riparian areas, create fire breaks, and regenerate the living soil sponge created by healthy soil life. We'll pick up now where we left off last month in our conversation.
So, you know, where I used to hate cows, being a forester on public lands, I realized the cows have nothing to do with it. It's all about us. So anyway, you know, we tried riding a lot then, and we tried keeping them out of riparian areas, but the wolves actually changed everything. And people ask me if I'm grateful that the wolves came. And, you know, when you lose over $100,000, you're not grateful for anything, you know, because they're going to put us out of business type thing. And so that would be kind of a foolish thing to say. Because, you know, if we're not profitable, Vanessa, we don't have a business and we're not ranching. So these wolves are eating us literally out of house and home. And Carol and I knew we had to change something dramatically about how we viewed that range. So this is where this in-herding idea came from. This is intentional herding of cattle that's 24/7. So we started doing that the following year after we lost our most. That was 14 head in one season. And the following year, we just lived with our cattle 24/7. We just adopted the old ways. Shepherds and herdsmen have done this for literally thousands of years. They still do it. And, you know, I saw an article in Botswana, out of Botswana the other day, and they have lions and they're herding their cattle into these night pens every night. And I held the magazine up to my wife. I said, look at this. Look, this is an amazing picture, because this was a picture of Botswana and there's like 500 head of cattle in this night pen. And there's these lions walking around the outside of the night pen, not wanting to come in because the night pen is this barrier that lions won't cross. And so we started adopting the same thing after hearing about French and Spanish and Italian shepherds doing this practice to prevent predation. So we started putting them in night pens. I didn't find out about the Botswana thing until recently, but there's this coincidental upswing of putting animals in night pens all across the world. I had a great phone conversation with a guy on Zoom from Nepal the other day. He's doing the same thing we are. And it's like, you know, we didn't read the same things necessarily. We just came at the same conclusion. We have to control our cattle 24/7. And we got to put them in these night pens in order to prevent predation and not have these negative interactions. So anyways, we started doing that. And when we started doing that, Carol, the riparian ecologist, PhD gal, said, wait, if we have total control over cattle, that means we don't have to graze riparian areas anymore. So like I said, we have 55 miles of creeks up there, Vanessa. A lot of wet meadows. And she said, okay, from now on, why don't we try instigating this? What do you think? And I said, you know what? We got control of these cattle. We just got to learn how to herd them. We got to have the stockmanship principles in place. And we did it. And we had a partnership with the Nature Conservancy at that point in time, because I called a friend of mine there and said, Mark, we need help because we have no idea what we're doing here. And we want to embark on this thing. And he came over, we had some coffee, and it was late in the evening and we had a flip chart, and I drew a picture of what this could look like to Mark. And he said, I'm in, and TNC's in. And they gave us $25,000 a year for 3 years to just figure out this methodology. And it worked. And it took a lot. Mark actually rode with us a lot up there. Boy, he got saddle sore. And but we laughed a lot, trying to figure out this thing that people have been doing, Vanessa, for thousands of years before us. And what's ironic is, we live in a huge cowboy culture in central Idaho. You have the same cowboy culture in Colorado. I've talked to a lot of them. And these people are horsemen. They know how to ride well. They're handy on the ranch. They can rope. But I realized that we've learned a stockmanship that's based on the principle of continual pressure. And for us to win and actually make money on these rangelands by gaining weight, we need to remove the pressure because cattle under pressure don't gain weight. And this is the test. And this is the 5-year-old granddaughter I could tell this to. The test is if those cattle have their head up, you're not making money. If those cattle have their head down, you're making money. It's really that simple. That sounds like, oh, well, that's idiotic. But we found that when we got started, these cattle had their head up all the time. And that means we're not making money. So, it's key for us to be able to make money while we're doing this. So we figured that out. It took about 3 years to figure out those stockmanship principles to get those cattle to want to do what we need them to do. And we wanted them to graze with our presence on the ground with them. Before they wouldn't. They would raise their heads up and never, they just expected pressure all the time because that's how our minds worked. But when we change our mind into getting them to want to do what we need them to do, and that was to keep their heads down, then we just figured out the tools that we needed to make that happen and create a little bit of pressure with tons and tons of release. So that was key. That, when we got that, the riparian area just completely turned around. And we could talk about water quality, we could talk about muddy creeks and all these things. But here's the deal. Let me just ratchet you 13 years farther down the road where we are today. When we're in a cow camp, we now pipe the water. We have Forest Service style on the ground pumps that we just pump the water up to a tank up on an upland, on a sagebrush upland away from the creek. Maybe it's 100 feet, maybe it's 300 yards, so that the cattle don't walk into the creek. But you know what's crazy, Vanessa? This is the sea change of what it looks like. This is a creek in the Rocky Mountain West, okay? When people run out of water in their canteens and their saddlebags, they all know, my whole crew knows, that they can walk over to either the creek or the pump pipeline that comes out of the creek and pours into the tank and fill their canteen with no filter. We don't use water filters anymore. We threw them all away. Because our water quality got to the point where it's just this window pane clarity. And there's fish, we were finding fish in places we never seen fish before. These bull trout, they're a state sensitive species. They spread, and we were getting all these amphibians. We were getting all these animals showing up in our creeks that we never had before because our cattle weren't using. So there's no water quality issue. There's no fecal coliform content from our cattle anymore in these creeks. So we started drinking out of them with our cow camps, and we still do it today. And it's because the cows aren't in the creek anymore. Thankfully, our watershed is completely controlled by our cattle and our range and our management. So, that means there's no cattle in our creeks. And so it changed everything. And, the fact that we could drink out of it was to me the litmus test that we had reinstated water quality to what it was. When we think about it, like Coors, you got that Coors Brewery in Golden, Colorado, and they say brewed with pure Rocky Mountain spring water. That is the stereotype of what we think about the Rocky Mountains, pure Rocky Mountain spring water, pure Rocky Mountain spring water. We think those things in our mind's eye, but yet we go up there and we find muddy creeks because the cattle have been in them all day. That's where they live. They followed the 2 G's, and that's where they live all day. And they're crapping in the creeks, they're knocking down the banks. And they're ruining the water quality downstream. They're changing the color of the Colorado River, to what was pretty clean water, most times of the year, to now a little bit of sediment effluent running through Glenwood. And sadly, that's a lot of that is cattle on the land who are either directly impacting a creek or doing what we call non-point source pollution, where they actually have changed the plant ecosystem above ground and now have created a soil that doesn't receive water anymore. It's a non-infiltrating soil. And the reason the soils change is because biodiversity of plant species above ground have changed because of continuous grazing. So now we only have few species. When you have only a few species above ground, that then changes the whole nature of biodiversity below ground. And so before you had a living soil sponge that would receive water all day long, that the water wouldn't run off. It would just receive it. Like our infiltration tests on our home ranch, we can receive 3 inches of water even while we're irrigating. We have pivot irrigation down there. Even while we're irrigating, we can receive 3 inches of water in 1 minute and 20 seconds.
Wow.
Up on the BLM, right across the fence, like we're talking a few hundred yards from where that's happening. It's gravelly, sandy soil. I take interns up there because I want to show them this. I'll put an infiltration ring. We pour our 444 cc's of water into that infiltration ring, that 6 inches in diameter. That represents 1 inch of rainfall. So you pour that into your infiltration ring that you pounded into the ground. And I'll take bets from the interns. After seeing that 1 minute and 20 seconds of 3 inches of infiltration on the ground just a few hundred yards away, they're like, well, this is gravelly. It's going to go in immediately. And what happens instead, Vanessa, on those non-biodiverse rangelands, because we've lost all our key species from continuous grazing of both cattle and sheep, is you pour that water in there, that 444 cc, to make that 1 inch depth. And I say to my crew, hey, now we're going to go up the creek and we're going to look at some watershed issues we got along riparian areas up there. This is not our range, by the way. This is somebody else's. It's somebody else's grazing and they continuously graze. And they say, wait, don't you want to see how long it takes for the 1 inch to go underground? And I just smile at them, say, let's get in the truck. We'll take a drive. And we come back an hour later. I mean, an hour later, Vanessa. And that 1 inch of water is still sitting there
Oh my gosh.
on the BLM land. And it's because it can't take it. And the reason it can't take it is because there's no living matrix. There's no living soil sponge there to receive water anymore. This is why we have water problems all over the West. This is why the Colorado will run muddy a lot of times. It's because we've lost soil infiltration capability because we've lost all the biodiversity below ground. And it's from continuous cattle grazing. And so I'm not against cattle grazing now. I realize, wait, there's a way to do this and change the whole nature of the West. In fact, this is crazy. Everybody's like, well, you've reduced the amount of cattle. That's the key here. You reduce the amount of cattle, and of course you're going to get results. And at first we did when we were trying to figure out this grazing scenario because we didn't know what we were doing. We were losing cattle. We were like, oh my gosh, we can't keep them in a herd. Now we can run anything. And we're running about 500 head up there now when we used to run 200. And here's the nutty thing is now my daughters are so keen on stockmanship. We'll be driving across some open area of Colorado, that's got rolling hills of sagebrush grazing, or even, Wyoming or something like that. And I'll say, okay, you guys, tell me what it looks like. You're running cattle on here. You're herding like we are. You're gaining weight on these yearlings or your mama cows, whatever you're running. How many head do you have in your care and how many people on your team? And tell me what else you need. And it's just a hypothetical situation, but this is what's gotten into their heads. So my oldest daughter, she's Melanie, 32 years old. She'll say something like, oh, here? Wait, you want us to run cattle here? And I'm like, yeah, let's run cattle here. Just in your mind's eye, based on the grass and the vegetation, And, we have some of the most broken country on earth. It's like grazing in Glenwood Canyon. I'm not kidding you. It's like that. It is rough. It is super rough country. But they'll look at this rolling expanse of grassland and sagebrush going out before them, and they'll say, I can run 2,000 head with one other person and four stock dogs.
Wow.
And so it's so possible when you get the paradigm of, creating tons of release and respecting those cattle and getting them trained to being herded again and kind of rebooting that herd instinct to where they stay together and we keep encouraging it. And people will say, well, what's the analog to that in a wildland situation? Before we came along. And the analogs are so easy, Vanessa, because there were wolves and grizzly bears everywhere, right?
Right.
So these animals were the herders, but they actually, did create adverse pressure sometimes because they're predators. But they did keep these animals together as a herd because in the herd was numbers and protection. So we're just kind of rebooting that instinct with our cattle. And it's really cool because all of a sudden we have this tool now that we can use to actually enhance forest ecosystems. Let me give you another example. I had the district ranger from the local Forest Service up there. And we're looking at these aspen stands and all this Douglas fir that's encroaching in them. And it's about a 5,000-acre watershed we're looking at. And she said, what can we do about this? Because she's got a heart for aspen as well, for trying to reinstate that as part of the kind of polyculture that we had in those trees before continuous grazing started happening for the past 120 years. And I said, you know what? There's all kinds of cool things we could do here. And I said, let me throw you out one that I've been thinking about. She says, shoot. I said, so this 4,000 acre pasture, what if we don't graze that for the next 2 years? She said, you'd have to fence it all. I said, well, no, not with our deal. And she said, oh, yeah, you could herd them so you don't graze that. And I said, yeah. So we could say we won't have cattle in there for 2 years because we're going to not let them go in there because we're herding around that area. And we'll graze everything actually pretty hard, like down to the dirt, in a band that's maybe, 100 yards wide, all around that area. And I said, what do you have now? And she knew because she was a fire person. She said, you have a defensible perimeter and you have fine fuels built up in the interior. And that means you could succeed with a spring burn. Because the fine fuels in the spring dry out very quickly, right? But you have to have them. And the 1,000-hour fuels, the timber and the down logs, all that stuff takes a long time to dry out. So it's probably not going to really burn really well. But the fine fuels will. And the fine fuels flashing through in the spring or even in the late fall, as we're, looking at snow in the forecast, that's a good time to do this as well. You're going to burn through and you're going to kill those aspens because they're thin bark. So they're going to regenerate. And you're going to torch the Douglas firs because they got thin bark when they're young and they got conifer branches close to the ground. So the flames will scorch them and kill them. And so as a result, you're going to reinstate an aspen stand in a non-hazardous way. And the tool that got you to where you could do this is targeted grazing. And it's because you control our cattle. And here's the crazy thing about technology right now. We're embarking on these collars. You've probably heard of these collars on these animals this year. So you know what? With these collars, these are collars connected to an antenna or GPS, and you can put these things called virtual fences around cattle, just like people have virtual fences for their dogs, for their dogs around their house. These cattle will have those collars on them as well. So we're still going to live with them on the ground and still do some herding to use night grounds and still do herding and working with them because we have to have human presence up there in the face of wolves and top of the food chain predators like mountain lions. We have a ton of mountain lions up there. And so we got to have that human presence on the ground. But we can have these polygon perimeters around our cattle instead of reinforcing our own perimeter all the time on horseback. Instead, we could just, be range riding, making sure our cattle are in a general area all together within a polygon, bringing them down to night grounds that are, small hot wire enclosures overnight, just like the lion people were doing in Botswana, turn them back out. And that way we have both boxes checked. We have wolf predation met, and we have these ecosystem objectives met. So anyway, those are things that we're just trying to get. It's way beyond riparian. It now moves up into uplands, and it actually moves into this place where we're building above ground biodiversity. We did some sampling, some line intercept sampling, and some vegetative cover sampling along with soil and infiltration rates. We found that places where we're practicing this herding and long rest periods, we'll go 3 years before we come back to most of our ground to graze it again. Whereas most ranges are grazed at least at some season every year. Where we started doing that, we found that our soil organic matter has doubled. It went from 3 to 6% organic matter. This is on dry rangelands. Our plant cover has doubled, and our species diversity has doubled. Our infiltration has doubled as well. So the amount of water a piece of ground will take, instead of just being bulletproof to water, it'll absorb that rainfall. And that's, absorbing rainfall is the key to reinstating water cycles. I don't care if you're an orchardist or an ornamental nursery grower, but if you don't have soil life, you'll find you're having a really hard time getting soil penetration for your water. It'll just run off, and you got to put, a rim around your plants to hold water there to give it time to penetrate. That's not true if you have a high degree of soil biology. If you got a high degree of soil biology, your water is going to go in. I find it really interesting. I go to Central Valley, California. I'll drive through there, and I'll see these almond orchards, or I'll see viticulturists. I'll see vineyards, and the glyphosate used there is ubiquitous. It's very, very infrequent that I see a grassland with diversity underneath either of those things, either almonds or grapevines. And we're just spraying glyphosate all over those things in the Central Valley. And so now we have this soil that's got no life on it. The only life growing out of the soil is the vines of the grapes and the almond trees. And the reason they're not dying is because we're not spraying them, with a foliar spray like we do with glyphosate. So we spray these glyphosate things, not we personally, but we humans do this. And we think, oh, these plants aren't using our water anymore in these viticulture systems and these orchard systems. So that means we're going to have more water for our plants. And in a drip system, you can think that way. But if you're, sprinkle irrigating or anything like that, where you're not being, discretionary about exactly where that water goes, well, then you're not thinking right. Because a lot of that water, before it penetrates into the ground and starts actually watering the roots of your key plants, your woody plants that you're trying to grow, a lot of it will evaporate right off the soil. And if you have hills at all, it'll run off. And so you're actually losing, because you lost not only the biodiversity that receives and holds water, and stores it very efficiently, but you've also lost the ability for your woody plants in your orchard or your vines to be able to integrate themselves with soil mycorrhizal organisms that are entwined with all these other plants and all these other soil biological organisms underground. And so you've really lost. You've actually lost. And because what's the number one cost in places like the Central Valley, or even in a place like Glenwood Spring, or even a place like May, Idaho, where we live? We all live in semi-desert environs because of rain shadows. And so water actually becomes one of our number one costs. And yet, we're continually compromising it by using something like glyphosate and eliminating or reducing soil biota to the extent that we lose so much water because of the lack of a living soil sponge. So that's the game changer for us. It's creation of a living soil sponge because we're reinstating the water cycle. And I think we've missed that in agriculture, whether it be, permaculture or, thinking about orchards in those contexts is like we've sacrificed all the other life. This goes back into the regenerative thing, right? We've sacrificed all other life for this one plant. And we are actually extracting and reducing life instead of regenerating it. We're degenerating life by those kind of practices.
Well, I love how these examples illustrate that where one could see the cattle as the problem, actually they can be the solution. And also they illustrate how you're regarding future care, a fair share of resources or care for future resources. Once again, due to our time constraint, I'll have to air the final part of my interview with Glenn Elzinga of Alder Spring Ranch in next month's episode. If you'd like to follow up with Glenn Elzinga and Alder Spring Ranch, you can find their website at alderspring.com. That's alderspring.com. There you can shop for beef, lamb, pork, salmon, dairy, beef sticks, and tallow skincare. You can join Meat Hackers, a newsletter about allergy-free meat meal recipes and cooking tips. You can apply for range internships. There are resources for ranchers with a 5-day free course about how to start selling online and shipping your frozen meat product. And you can find links to other news, press, and praise, as well as a link to their Instagram profile, alderspring_ranch. Thank you to our listeners for joining us today. I'm your host, Vanessa Harmony of Colorado Edible Forest in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Tune in next month on KDNK on the third Monday of the month at 4 p.m. for another episode of Living Permaculture. I'll talk to you then.